Huh. That's weird. Wonder how my gain got turned down. I guess my gain must have got turned down, man. Oh. Hey, how are you guys doing? Welcome to the show. It's the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's the 27th of December 2013. I am live here today, this Friday. Had a nice little vacation, but hey, business is business, right? All right. Oh man, I forgot to sign in the chat room. Sign in the chat room. Why not? You know, there are times where sometimes on holidays you see people in the chat room you don't usually see. What the? All right. Well, so I'm joining up the chat room. ScottHorton.org/chat. You can do that if you want. Sheldon Richmond's going to be on the show today. We're going to talk about Iran. Well, we're going to talk about Israel's men in the U.S. Senate and what all they have to say about America's Iran policy. You know, since it's up to them. So, Sheldon be on to talk about that. And then Grant F. Smith, our friend from the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy, is going to be back on the show to talk about his new piece about the new incoming number two man at the Federal Reserve System, the vice chair of the Open Market Committee, I guess would be his title, right? Something like that. Anyway. He's coming straight from the head of the Israeli Central Bank. Position to be the deputy over there at the Fed. I wonder what kind of arguments he and Yellen, the actual chair, are going to have. We ought to print some more money. No, we ought to print even more money than that. No, we ought to print even more money than that. You know what I think we should do? Inflate some more. I bet you interest rates, we ought to make them lower. Oh, yeah, well, okay. It's agreed then. Or we'll just have to agree to disagree and inflate some more. Okay, good. So anyway, that should be interesting. Grant Smith wrote a very interesting article about this guy's history. Someone in the chat room is asking about an Ann Applebaum column. No, thank goodness. I've been spared that horror up until now. I guess if you leave me the link, I'll take a look at it. Yeah, Putin hates us for our freedoms. I'm sure that's at the top of his list of things that he hates us for. All right, well, so hang on, I'm going to drink some coffee really fast, a lot of it, and then we'll see what happens when it crosses the blood-brain barrier. Probably not very much, but I'm counting on a little anyway. It's tastier if I spill it in my beard. So, out of sheer self-hatred, I'm watching MSNBC today. Their caption's broken. I know you guys don't hate the impaired. What's up with some captions? Is it working? Oh, okay. No? Oh, there it is. All right. That was just my settings here. Well, I was watching this movie where the captions were way ahead of the dialogue, and it was kind of ruining it. It was an old Rodney Dangerfield classic that I've never heard of before. It wasn't very funny, but it had Rodney Dangerfield in it, so that was good. It was already on my permanent record anyway. I might as well say it on the radio. All right, so lots to talk about on the show and not too much time, so here's some talking. Amazon.com. If you're buying stuff from Amazon, stop by my website first. In fact, you don't even need to do that. Just type in scotthorton.org/Amazon. And that'll send you to Amazon, only then I'll get a cut from their end. I'll get a kickback from their end. Costs you the same no matter what. Not one penny extra. It only costs them to pay me a little bit of kickback for their referral program there. So just like you can do with a lot of other sites that you like, well, do it at my site instead. Or two. Also, whichever you like best. ScottHorton.org. And in fact, if you just look at the right side of the front page there, you'll see a gigantic brown Amazon logo. Click on that. There you go. And so it's just a little something, but it helps the show to continue being the show. So if you're buying stuff from Amazon anyway, you might as well make sure that the show gets a little bit of a kickback, right? And by the way, Amazon sells everything in the world, not just books. I'm pretty sure you can get a riding lawnmower from Amazon.com. You can get anything from Amazon.com. I'm not sure what my cut would be on a riding lawnmower, but probably be all right. So get all your riding lawnmowers and all your books and all your everything at Amazon, but make sure and stop by scotthorton.org first. All right, I'm not very good at pitching that. I guess I'll have to figure out how to say that quickly and effectively. Shop Amazon by way of my site. But I got to figure out how to convince you to do that without beating you over the head too bad anyway. Yeah. And so then while I'm at it, then I can also mention just thanks to all my sponsors who've helped get me through this year. And there's a long list of them, of course. Future Freedom Foundation, the Council for the National Interest, Wall Street Window, LibertyStickers.com. Dagny Lane's been helping out, although still don't have a spot for them to run. And of course, the Great 10th Amendment Center. And you, coming up soon. I should say Chris Braswell, Braswell Communications as well. But your company could advertise on the show. There's a company making blue jeans that they say they're going to advertise on the show once they get up and going. So there you go. Everybody likes blue jeans. Can't not make money making blue jeans. So anyway. But yeah, so thanks very much to my sponsors. I'm very grateful and gratitudinal and appreciate it and all that. Also, if you want to hear me give a talk, I'm going to practice so it's real good. I'm going to give a talk at the Students for Liberty Conference in Washington, D.C. on February the 15th. It's the Future Freedom Foundation Conference at the Students for Liberty Conference. And it's going to be cool because Sheldon's going to be there and Bob Higgs and Jacob Hornberger and John Glazer from antiwar.com and other places. Washington Times, Huffington Post. There you go. Left-right libertarian realignment in practice right there. He's going to be my partner in this talk that we're giving, Libertarianism versus the Empire. So if you live on the East Coast or you just got so much money that you don't mind flying around the country for fun, for events and stuff like that, then all right, see you there. February 15th at the Students for Liberty Conference. And then, you know, they say Oliver Stone's going to be there, giving one of the keynotes, and Jeremy Scahill's going to be there headlining. Stephen Kinzer, author of the new book Brothers about the Foster, John Foster and Alan Dulles, the Rockefeller's lawyers. Eisenhower's head of the CIA and Secretary of State. And so that should be awesome. Bob Higgs is going to be there. How do I trick these people into coming to see me give a speech? Bob Higgs is going to be there. In fact, I promise you an autograph from Bob Higgs if you come see my speech. No, I don't. I have no authority to promise any such thing. I'm just trying to lie and manipulate you into showing up. Wouldn't that be cool? All right. Don't buy me a beer, though, because I don't drink. But see there. Okay, now the news. I got lots and lots of news. First of all, Barack Obama, the president. Yeah, he signs the National Defense Authorization Act, another $700-something billion for wars and preparedness for more wars. And apparently, Congress relaxed the regulations a little bit on who is allowed to leave Guantanamo after they've been cleared for release. He says, Obama says the law does not eliminate all of what he called unwarranted limitations on foreign transfers, and said that in certain circumstances, the law violates constitutional separation of powers principles. Really? Well, of course it does. He's the commander-in-chief. He can simply close down that prison and order the military commanders at Guantanamo Bay to deliver them to Miami, to the port. And I guess, I don't know if he could order Eric Holder, but he could certainly suggest to Eric Holder that he better have some agents waiting to arrest them there and charge them. Remember, Holder wanted to do that, and then Obama balked. Those were on the few that they even wanted to give a trial at all. The rest are already known to be completely innocent and unconvictable. But I'm so tired of Barack Obama pretending like he wants to close Guantanamo Bay when he doesn't want to close Guantanamo Bay. He could have closed it all along all by himself. And then, you know, even if you take for granted that, oh, he has to respect Congress's wishes in the Defense Authorization Act, he could veto it. But he doesn't. Year after year after year, he signs all the laws that they pass restricting his ability to close down the prison. But meanwhile, he's the president. He could start a war in Libya at 3 a.m. if he wants to, based on a proverbial phone call and his own feeling about whether he feels like it or not. He can sure as hell close down the Guantanamo Bay prison. Oh, it's a symbol that helps radicalize people against us, he says. Really? How about this headline? An appeals court has again rejected habeas corpus petitions filed by alleged enemy combatants held in Afghanistan at the Bagram Airfield military base. In the 44-page decision, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit agreed with the government. Agreed with Barack Obama. And ruled that the five prisoners who filed suit were beyond the reach of the U.S. Constitution. Unlike the men held at Guantanamo Bay. Guantanamo, the court stated, does not lie in a theater of war. While, quote, our forces at Bagram are actively engaged in a war with a determined enemy. As an aside, one might wonder whether a war has changed into an occupation. And whether that affects the legal analysis. War is dynamic and necessitates flexibility. An occupation is more static and perhaps is closer to a civilian model. That's exactly what I was going to interrupt and say. I thought they won the war back in October of 2001. This is all just a policing mission protecting the legitimate government of Afghanistan from these alien Taliban insurgents, wherever they come from. What about all that? But, oh well, of course, just going along with the executive branch's lies. But that's how much Barack Obama cares about the rule of law and habeas corpus and making sure that America's not maintaining a bunch of secret prisons with legal black holes where abductees just go to rot and die with no hope of ever having process for relief. How do you like that? Yeah, we're not even going to give you a fake trial and convict you. We're just going to hold you forever, and you're never even going to get a chance to ask anybody to think twice. Guess you could beg your guard, see how good that does you. Amazing. All right, so that's Guantanamo and Bagram for you. Now, let's see, there's my Sheldon section. Oh, here's my NSA section. First of all, New York judge rules NSA phone surveillance is legal. contradicting the other federal judge from last week. But that's all right. This thing was going to the Supreme Court anyway. This is just setting us up for the fight in the Supreme Court over this thing, which really gives me the heebie-jeebies. I'm sorry, I couldn't come up with anything else. I don't like it because the Supreme Court, well, they're supreme. And if they say that the executive branch can do whatever it wants, then that's that. Until the next time they feel like revisiting the exact same question and ruling in the opposite manner, good luck with that. So now Judge Leon said, this is madness. This is absolutely unconstitutional. This is absolutely in violation of the Fourth Amendment. And he didn't say absolutely. He said, boy, it sure seems like it. And remember, he stayed his own injunction. He went through the motion of issuing an injunction, but then stayed it and said, look, obviously this is going to be appealed and ruled and decided at a higher court level, and it's an immediate national security interest and everything, at least claimed, so I won't presume to really stop it. But that was his ruling, was that he said if James Madison was here, he would be aghast that the rule of law which creates this national government in the first place forbids it from doing these very things. So now this other judge has said, nuh-uh, I think it's great. In fact, see, the ABC version sucks, man. The New York Times version had the quote from the judge. Is this it? Yeah, where the judge said, the quote that I want to read you, if I can get this thing to pull up here. This blunt tool only works because it collects everything, Judge Pauley said in the ruling. While robust discussions are underway across the nation, in Congress and at the White House, the question for this court is whether the government's bulk telephony metadata program is lawful. This court finds it is, he added. The Justice Department said we're pleased that the court has agreed with them about this. There you go. All right, now, speaking of metadata, you can read about this at the blog at antiwar.com. The Stanford University study that has come out saying, he's got the link to it here, saying that it is trivially easy to identify people with metadata. It's linked here at antiwar.com/blog. And they said, come on, all this metadata, all you have to do is just enter anything in Google. It'll pull up names and addresses and whatever you want. And if you're the NSA, you already have access to all these databases anyway. Every public database is all wired straight into their network anyway. So, it's not like there's a mystery at all about who they're tapping and who they're watching. And then, real quick, oh man. NSA stories. Everyone keeps saying, well, if Snowden is such a good guy, why didn't he come home and face the music? What a stupid Democrat talking point. If you ever said that, you're stupid. You let a Democrat rape you right in the brain. What's the matter with you? Give me a break. As Trevor Tim argues here at pressfreedomfoundation.org, he wouldn't be able to argue in court that what he did was the right thing for any reason whatsoever. That would be inadmissible. Of course. And a great article, How to Defeat Big Brothers, at Salon.com today as well. Go look at that. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. Libertystickers.com. Everyone else is stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. Yes, in case you're tuning in late, we're live today, the 27th of December, 2013. I don't guess I ever will quit doing this, as long as I can keep it going anyway. I like being a radio show host. This is a good job. All right. Yeah, we're here live 3 to 5 weekdays on the Liberty Express. Hang on, I got a burp. I'm going to turn this mic off first. Man, it's all the Dr. Pepper. All right, and so now, well, I'm going to save most of my Israel discussion for the Sheldon Richmond interview coming up here. But did you see this one? Netanyahu calls for probe of NSA spying in Israel. This is from the 23rd at McClatchy Newspapers. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Monday that he has ordered a probe into reports that the United States and Britain had monitored communications of the previous prime minister and defense minister, calling the actions unacceptable. Netanyahu also reiterated Israel's call for the release of Jonathan Pollard, an American Navy intelligence analyst sentenced to life in prison in 1987 for spying for Israel. Documents leaked by Edward Snowden, a former contractor for the NSA, which detailed surveillance by the agency and Britain's eavesdropping agency, the government communications headquarters, showed that in 2009, they had monitored email traffic of several Israeli officials, including Ehud Olmert, the Israeli prime minister at the time, and the defense minister, Ehud Barak. So, anyway, Netanyahu calls for an investigation, and then, so I was just wondering, why don't they just look in the daily haul that the NSA turns over to Israel on a regular basis, everything they've got? Remember that one from The Guardian? The only place it made the New York Times was their public editor agreeing with complaining readers that, I can't believe you guys didn't cover this. The NSA, not only are they mirroring the entire internet, basically, and saving it all, they're sharing everything they've got with the Israelis. That should have been the biggest or second biggest scandal out of this whole Snowden fiasco so far. NSA fiasco. And then Netanyahu. Oh, boo-hoo. I want an investigation to find out the truth of all this. Yeah, look in your files. So we already know you've got it all. All right. Iraq. I'm going to get back to Israel stuff in just a minute. Well, Iran stuff. Iraq, a grim holiday. Iraqi Christians are target. Attackers target Christian neighborhoods, churches. Sectarian clashes. This is Jason Ditz from Christmas Day at news.antiwar.com. Sectarian clashes in Iraq have been getting worse and worse throughout the year. And Christmas provided no real respite, though it did appear to shift the focus of attacks onto the nation's Christian minority. And then here is Baghdad Christians targeted, 75 killed, 141 wounded. Also from antiwar.com. This is from antiwar.com/updates. Margaret Griffiths keeps track of all the Iraq violence still to this day as the war there rages on. Day after day it rages on. And so then, by the way, the big news about Iraq is that the U.S. is sending drones and Hellfire missiles to the Maliki regime. But I wanted to point you guys toward this thing that you can't see yet, I don't guess, but soon you will. It's a guy named James Gundon, who's written this piece for antiwar.com, which I suspect will run tomorrow, over the weekend. U.S. drone aid won't repair Iraq's woes. And, man, there's so little good reporting coming out of Iraq these days. It sounds stupid, but I actually, when I'm reading all this news, it occurred to me that I ought to try to get Michael Hastings on the line, because he was one of the few reporters that I knew who was good on Iraq, who really knew what he was talking about. But, of course, he's not alive. There are very few people that I know anymore. You know, Dar Jamail's writing about global warming and all this crap now. I don't know who's writing about Iraq anymore, but this guy, James Gundon, has done a pretty good job with this one. Again, it's called U.S. Drone Aid Won't Repair Iraq's Woes. And it's just all about how Maliki is, he's made himself enemies on all sides. But he's also, you know, he's done so by consolidating power and freezing out anyone who's not already completely under his thumb from any access to power. Which, of course, has led to the current crises. And then, of course, there's the whole irony of the Americans sending drones and Hellfire missiles to Iraq to help back up the Shiite dictatorship, pretended democracy, to protect them from the Sunni insurgency. Which is the exact opposite of the policy, which, of course, you know, that's the same policy since 2003 for Iraq, but it's the exact opposite of the policy across the border in Syria right now, where America's still backing the jihadists against the Shiite Baathists. So, I guess, you know, if you can fly your remote control airplanes around and drop enough Hellfire missiles to chase Al-Qaeda in Iraq, all of them across the border into Syria, then they become good guys once they cross that imaginary line. And now all of a sudden they're loyal shock troops of the American Empire, getting Israel and Saudi Arabia's dirty work done, supposedly weakening Iran, although, not really. Certainly spreading the war to Lebanon. As we've seen over and over again here, Hezbollah claims it killed Syrian Nusra rebels sneaking into Lebanon. That's from McClatchy newspapers. And then here, leading pro-Western politician killed in powerful Beirut blast. That's from today at CBSNews.com. A powerful car bomb killed a prominent Lebanese politician critical of Syria and its ally Hezbollah, hitting his SUV Friday as it drove through a ritzy business district near Beirut's waterfront. Shredding trees and shattering glass. Yeah. Anyway. Former finance minister Mohammed Chatta. I don't know anything about him. I don't know. But that's what they're saying. Of course, Hezbollah has always just stayed put in southern Lebanon. But now they've gone into Syria to fight to help back up the Baathist government there. In order to serve as Iran and the Baathist shock troops to protect the regime and the holy sites from the American and Saudi and Israeli-backed and Qatari and Turkish-backed Al-Qaeda fighters there. Maybe we should reinvade Iraq. What about that? Anybody ready to volunteer to go back to Iraq? Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers state that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richmond, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richmond at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here. All right, y'all. I'm Scott Horton. Welcome back to the show. Again, we are live today, the 27th of December, 2013 here. Hope everybody had a Merry Christmas. Our first guest on the show today is Sheldon Richman, the vice president of the Future of Freedom Foundation and editor of their journal, The Future of Freedom. Welcome back, Sheldon. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, and it's great to be back with you.
Good times. Well, I'm very happy to have you here. Now, you've got an article here about Iran, and this might be confusing for some people in our audience today, Sheldon, because we were just talking about how America's policy since 2003 has been to back Iran in Iraq. But when it comes to Iran, we're against Iran. We're only for them in Iraq. We're against them everywhere else. Is that right?
Yeah, it is really bizarre. I've for a long time thought about what the Bush people could have had in mind when they went into Iraq, knowing the government was the new government would end up being lean toward Iran. The only sense I can make of it is they had Iran in their sights as the next stop, and then knock out Iran, and then help undermine the new Iraq government. But I don't know what they were thinking. It does still puzzle me.
Well, I think maybe what happened was the Ayatollah told Shalaby to tell Paul Wolfowitz that, oh, yeah, the Iraqi Shiites, they love America way more than they love Iran, and they're going to freeze out Iran, and they're going to make Iran look really bad for not being nearly as democratic as the new Shiite Iraq is going to be. And then that'll shame the Ayatollah into holding more and better elections. And then they'll elect Paul Wolfowitz to be the new leader of Iran, I guess. I don't know.
But as you have many times pointed out, and some of your guests as well, Sadr in Iraq, who was a leading Shiite, was also sort of the least leaning toward Iran among the Shiite leaders. Mm-hmm. And yet the United States opposed him. So that doesn't make sense. If you figure the Shiites are going to become the power in Iraq once you knock out Saddam Hussein, it seems like you would side with Sadr, right? The guy that's more nationalistic and less prone to be influenced by Iran. And yet that's not what those guys, the Bush administration did. So I keep scratching my head.
Yeah. Well, I think what made him anti-Iranian was the same thing that made him anti-American, was his Iraqi nationalism. And I think they underestimated him right off the bat, too. I went to find the original quote about, Sadr, don't worry about him. He's just some minor cleric, because I'd read that somewhere. But then when I Googled it, it turns out that the Bush people had repeated that over and over and over again. It wasn't just some idiot said that to Paul Bremer once, and then they kind of based a policy around that. But this was a thing that was, I don't know, just one of these slogans that they memorized up there in the Bush White House that, oh yeah, don't worry about Sadr. So I think they just kind of convinced themselves that he wasn't going to matter very much, and then they took him a long time and the hard way to figure out. But anyway.
Yeah, the best and the brightest, blunder into some area where they know nothing about what's going on.
Right. All right, so, and you know what? I think that's really apt when we're talking about these senators. I mean, they know what they're doing in a very limited way, but I don't think they really, Charles Schumer, does he really have much of a grasp of the scheme of things going on right now? As he and his allies in the Senate, a bipartisan group, as you point out in your article here, as they push to pass these sanctions to undermine the current nuclear deal?
Well, the answer to that is simple. They don't have to think about it. They let AIPAC do their thinking for them. And I really think that sums it up. I don't think they're capable of thinking that out two or three steps. They know that they don't want an agreement between the United States and Iran, which will end this Cold War, this idiotic Cold War that's been going on for, 34 years. So they're putting impossible conditions on any agreement, like Iran may not do any enrichment whatsoever, even to the 3% for electrical power, and which is, of course, Netanyahu's position in Israel. And they don't want an agreement. They don't want a rapprochement. They want they either want regime change or they want Iran to continue on as this pariah state because it's a great foil for the Israeli government. They can use it to take people's mind off the Palestinians, and they have this existential threat, so-called, to point to. I really wonder if they want regime change in Iran. What would they do if a sort of benign-looking regime succeeded the the Ayatollah, and Israel could no longer point to it as an existential threat. I think they need the existential threat.
Yeah, I mean, after all, what they're working on now, you couldn't call it regime change, but you could call it regime conversion or something, where they're basically, you know, they're never going to get Iran's independence back the way it used to be, you know, before 79, but they could bring them back into the fold, you know, the way they did Gaddafi before they betrayed him.
Yeah. Well, look, we have some experience in this, and you've talked about this lots of times back in, what is it, 09? You'll correct me on the date if I'm wrong, where Iran agreed that it wouldn't enrich uranium anymore, that it cut a deal after Obama had urged this. They came to an arrangement with Turkey and Brazil, right, to swap uranium for enriched uranium.
Well, they would quit going up to 20% anyway. They would stay at 3.6.
Going to 20%, which was demanded of them by Obama. So they sit down with Turkey and Brazil and come up with a deal where they'll trade their uranium for enriched 20%, which they can use for the medical isotopes. And Obama couldn't take yes for an answer. Obama said, never mind, that's not our demand anymore.
Right. Well, and in fact,
we know what's going on. They won't take yes for an answer. And I don't know about Obama, but who knows what position Obama will take in any given day. But we know that AIPAC and their people in the Senate and Netanyahu and the House and Netanyahu won't take yes for an answer. Anything that Iran agrees to won't be enough. We know that.
Right. Well, and the Brazilians complained, and the Turks too complained, that Obama had personally asked them to pursue that channel and make that deal. It was virtually the same deal he had offered them back in October, that they had begun to accept it, and then he told them no, and preempted them with, I guess, Israeli-sponsored Jandala attacks, and then, of course, Obama pretended to out their program at COM, the new facility they had just begun construction on, that they had already declared to the IAEA 4 days before, that he pretended was, you know, outing them for betraying all their agreements, et cetera, like that, in order to scotch the deal. Then a few months later, he has the Brazilians and the Turks make pretty much the same deal again, the 20% fuel swap, and then completely pulled the rug out from under the Brazilians and Turks, our allies, or at least our friend. Turkey's definitely our NATO ally, and Brazil's at least a friend, and we're doing it on Obama's behalf. He asked him to do it, and then hung him out to dry.
Well, one thing they get by not accepting that and instead going through these talks that are going on now is they can say, see, the sanctions worked. The sanctions got them to the table, which is what everybody likes to say. and erasing in an Orwellian way the facts that you just recited. Mm-hmm. Namely, at an earlier time, actually, you go back to 2001 or 2003, at an earlier time, before there was these biting sanctions, Iran was making dramatic overtures toward cooperating with the United States, and they were turned down. They were put on the list of the acts. They were joined to the axis of evil by Bush, and then when a grand deal was offered, Bush reprimanded the Swiss for even bringing the message to the United States, and then the events under Obama that you just recited. You get the feeling that maybe they don't want a settlement.
Yeah.
They just want to look like they want to look like they want one.
Well, which is, you know, it's confusing to me why they would try as hard as they've tried, the Democrats now, I mean the White House, the Obama administration, why they've tried as hard as they've tried to get the interim deal just to fail, because they could have just not tried this hard to even get the interim deal in the first place and still just claim that, hey, we tried. Why go through this level of show? I mean, do you think it's really some kind of policy fight within the departments? Maybe Kerry really doesn't or does want the deal, and Obama really does or doesn't on the other side, something like that? Or is it all just a play?
The speculation on my part would be pure guesswork. I mean, I just don't know. You'd have to know the people, I guess, and there are people better qualified to try to read those tea leaves. Maybe there is a fight within the administration, and some of them really want to go for this, realizing it's a golden opportunity, and others more susceptible to Israel's at least the Israeli government's wishes in the matter, and AIPAC, the political impact that AIPAC brings to it, are dragging their feet. So I wish I knew. I wish the inside story was being written. We may have to wait years before we read about it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, It looks like Obama has sent Kerry to the Senate to tell them, please wait, you know, and he's put them off this long anyway. I mean, maybe some of that's for show, but, you know, and they're both former Democrat senators themselves, the president and his secretary of state. It seems like, maybe I'm wrong, seems like the president himself is still a bigger lobby than Israel and the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee if he chooses to really stand up to them and insist.
Well, next year is an election year. And, you know, the Senate is not secure for the Democrats. That's already being talked about in other connections. Like the Democrats could lose the Senate. The House, of course, is totally up. A third of the Senate's up. And, you know, it's a bad time to be going against AIPAC. And Obama seems to be pushing against AIPAC right now. They got to have politics on their minds too. There are Democrats that don't want to lose their seats to a Republican, claiming that they're weak, or you know that they're weak on our closest ally Israel, and they don't want AIPAC against them putting money into their opposition. I mean, that's got to be on their minds. Yeah. And this what's going through the Senate right now, this pending bill from Menendez, Schumer, and Kirk, the Republican, is really disturbing, especially because of not only does it impose new sanctions, even though there is this delay and there's this 30-day business where Obama has to certify that Iran is behaving itself, so it does put the initiative on the side of the Congress. But worse than that is the clause that says if Israel decides to attack Iran, the U.S. is in. I mean, this is different, I think, from other alliances and bills that have been passed, where in effect, the U.S. government is saying if country X is attacked, we are obligated to, you know, come and help it somehow. So in the case of Japan or South Korea, but they don't say if those countries attack another country, the U.S. is in it. And I realize this language is non-binding, but I still think that's kind of a formality.
But how else are they going to start the war? Everybody knows Iran would never first strike Israel in a million years, Sheldon.
Well, of course. That's absolutely right. And if you look at the language of this thing, I mean, I love the language. If the government of Israel is compelled to take military action in legitimate self-defense against Iran's nuclear weapon program, so defense against the program. Someone pointed out, what is self-defense against a program?
Right.
What does that mean exactly? So there are the conditions, right? If it's compelled to take military action.
You know, what it means is they're defining what already exists there as a nuclear weapons program. They're defining, they're saying nothing needs to be done from what they have now to change it to something that needs to be attacked, in which case we'll call it defense.
Well, because what they consider a weapons program, they have a very odd, I think, an odd definition. They mean, and this is what I guess they sum up with the phrase breakout capability. Number one, you have uranium in any state of enrichment or non-enrichment. Number two, you have centrifuges. Number three, you have people who understand nuclear physics. If you have those three things, to them, that's a nuclear program.
Right.
Which a lot of countries may. I mean, apply to a lot of countries. But
in other words,
a weapon.
You got a breakout capability right there on Wikipedia.org.
Right. You just need to have knowledge. And, of course, they've been killing scientists. We know there have been, you know, covert activity assassinating scientists because they want to try to stamp out people who know, which is sort of impossible. You can always find other people to learn things. But if you merely have uranium, centrifuges, and know-how, then that constitutes an existential threat in this view. And the U.S. should not be a party to that.
Well, now, so I don't know if you've done the congressional count or anything like that, but Obama could certainly veto this and force the Senate to override the veto if it came to that, which it wouldn't come to that, would it? I mean,
you know,
he's a
big
stinking loser, but he's still the president over, and it's his party that controls the Senate.
Yeah. Well, this could be a really interesting fight between, you know, the Senate and AIPAC on one side, and the whole Congress and AIPAC on one side, and the president on the other side. But then you have don't forget, you have election considerations once again. I think it's going to be extremely interesting. I mean, strap yourself into your chair and, pull it up to the front row and let's watch this because it's going to be real interesting. I don't know how it's going to come out.
Yeah. Well, of course, my preferred policy is I don't care if the Russians give the Iranians 50 ready-made hydrogen bombs. I mean, I guess I'd prefer they wouldn't, but, it's funny because we always talk about what a lie it is that they're making nukes and sometimes forget to mention that, even if they are, it's still in the scheme of things, the U.S. state doesn't have any legitimate authority to try to prevent the Iranian state from doing any such thing.
Yeah, and like you said before, let's assume, quote, the worst-case scenario, that they're trying to make a nuclear weapon. That against all the evidence that you have gone through with expert guests over and over again. So let's assume that. So they end up making one nuclear warhead for some weirdo reason. What good is it against thousands of American warheads and, 200 to 400Israeli warheads, some of which are on submarines and immune to first strike, in other words, giving them a second strike capability. They're not suicidal. They're not mad mullahs, whatever you think of the Islamic Republic. I mean, I don't like theocracy. I don't like government of any kind, but certainly like theocracy. They're not suicidal. So they have no interest. And then so even if they did build one, it would be obviously for deterrent purposes and nothing else, because there's just no scenario in which they could see that as a useful weapon offensively. Mm-hmm. So it's just nuts. And again, I've made heroic assumptions about their intentions because there's no evidence. In fact, the evidence goes the other way. We know this. Again, I'm saying things that people can hear on your show, very frequently.
Well, did you hear the one with Peter Jenkins, who he was negotiating on behalf of the British back during the 03 through 05 freeze under the additional protocol and all of that, E3 negotiations. And he had come to the same conclusion that the CIA told Seymour Hersh that they had come to, that the Iranians, back when they were ever even considering nuclear weapons and, compiling a little bit of paperwork about how they might proceed down that path, it was only because they were afraid that the Republicans were going to have Saddam Hussein invade them again. That's all.
Yep.
Or the Democrats. Right. It was actually Jimmy Carter that had him do it, right? Once they were able to, and this is back to the beginning of the conversation, once they were able to use Ahmed Chalabi to lie the neocons into war on behalf of Israel, they thought, against Saddam in 2003, well, that was the last they needed to worry about that. Now they've got, might as well be Mexico or Canada as their next-door neighbor now.
Mm-hmm. Right, and hence we have the national intelligence estimates from, 07 and 2011 by the 16 American intelligence agencies saying, there's not been a decision to make a weapon. They're not making a weapon. Anything in the way of the beginnings of a program was scrapped in 2003, just like you said, with the overthrow of Saddam. And the Israeli intelligence people said the same thing. And so what do we need? What more do we need? And Netanyahu is simply using this to distract everybody from the Palestinians. And what are they doing now? Building more settlements. They've announced they're going to build more settlements. Some peace process.
Yeah, 2,000 new units going up. And that's what I was just going to ask you about, was have you ever seen the documentary The Gatekeepers?
I don't think I have.
Well, I had only ever found it on Pirate Bay without subtitles. But if you go to my new documentary section at scotthorton.org/documentaries, I got, all the good documentaries I could think of. I need to add a couple of more that I thought of since then. But there's about 3 or 4 pages worth of documentaries, other people's documentaries, not that I ever made any of them, that I've just embedded there, recommended viewing kind of stuff. And it's got the subtitles there. And what it is it's all interviews with former leaders of the Shin Bet, the internal security. If you count the West Bank as Israeli territory and then the Gaza Strip, then they're the, internal federal police or national police of Israel. And what they talk about is how they've all along thought, even though, of course, it's their job clamping down on anyone who resists, they've all along thought since 67 that it doesn't make any sense to try to hold on to the West Bank, especially forever like this. There are already people who live there, And they even quote that guy, that Justin Raimondo wrote about in his review of Max Blumenthal's book, Leibowitz, the rabbi, who talked about how, you know, occupying the West Bank and East Jerusalem and Gaza over the long term will change the character of the Israeli state to, you know, occupier and Quisling operator and all of these terrible things. And anyway, so the reason that I brought it up specifically, it's important, especially you mentioned how this Iran thing is a big distraction from it, so I kind of want to focus on it extra. But it finally occurred to me the other day, the correct answer to a question that I've talked about, I think, with you a few times, and with Phil Weiss especially, this comes up on the show, where he likes to ask me what I think regular other people in America think, the average, like, flyover country American hicks, what do they think of the situation with Israel? And so my best answer has always been, kind of don't know nothing about it, and you always hear just the poor little Israel side of things, but it's always pretty, you know, just a general impression. They never really explain about the occupation. But it finally occurred to me that that's not really right. You know what it is. It's they never really explain it. But this is the before you really look into it kind of capsule of the situation over there, Sheldon, is that the Palestinians are holding the Israelis hostage and waging a terrorist war against them, trying to take land away from the Israelis. And it's all just encapsulated in the slogan, land for peace. It's so unreasonable to insist that the Israelis should have to give up land for peace. And then nobody ever has to prove that it's their land, right? They only just make it sound like there's this terrorist horde coming from the east, and the only way, and how unreasonable and criminal of the world to insist that the Israelis should have to bribe them off by giving up land in order to not have suicide bombings on their buses and in their pizzerias and movie theaters anymore. And it's such a gigantic lie just packed into that little statement about what the peace proposal supposedly is, right? That they should give up this land, the implication that it belongs to them, that the West Bank is somehow Israeli territory, as though there aren't millions of Palestinians already living there, that they haven't been this whole time. And that's really the answer to the question about what I believe regular Americans think, you know, people who, and by regular Americans, I don't mean non-Jews, because I include Jews in this too, people who don't really care about foreign policy or think about the outside world at all, think about anything but their own life at all, you know, that's just kind of the general impression of the situation, is that, you know, poor little Israel is being held hostage by the terrorists.
Well, and, because they've been told that for, you know, since the late 40s by almost by everybody.
That's a lot worse than my previous mistaken answer that I thought that they just don't really understand. So I was trying to think back to what I used to think or whatever, and I guess I just didn't really understand. But I think that's what most people think they understand about it. You know, a little more clarity anyway. Sorry it took so long for me to explain.
And the ones that don't take that position, the one you just said, I think probably take the position of, oh, this is an ancient religious fight, you know, that, right. You know, I can't figure out. It just goes back to, you know, antiquity. And why don't those people get over it? And which, of course, it isn't. It's not an old religious dispute. It's a fairly recent property dispute, land dispute, and water dispute. It happens that the occupiers, the ones who have taken land from the Palestinians, you know, are saying this in the name of the Jewish people and that they're declaring a Jewish state. But that's not. I don't think that's really the essential issue. The issue is one group taking land from another group, but Americans are sympathetic to the Israelis, and you know you can see the reasons that aren't terribly relevant, but they still affect people. I mean, the stories of Germany and World War II and the Holocaust, but of course the Palestinians were nowhere near Germany during Hitler's regime, had nothing to do with it. But they still think the Palestinians are the ones at fault here. And the media reinforces this, and you just hear it everywhere you go. I mean, I try to monitor the media, especially these cable talk shows. When do you ever see a Palestinian spokesman or a Palestinian American on TV for any extended time speaking about all this?
Yeah, never.
You know, being given a chance to really spell it out. You don't see it. You see Israelis all the time, where you see representatives from Jewish American organizations that come on and give Israel's case. And of course, the Israelis can have a spokesman who speak perfect English. Like their ambassadors tend to not even have accents.
Right.
They're born and raised in the United States. Netanyahu, yeah. Went to Cheltenham High School outside of Philadelphia, and they worked with Romney in Massachusetts in the 70s in the finance industry. So, it's like advantage Israel, because it's all stacked up that way, and that's where the sympathies are. Of course, the Americans aren't going to understand it. How many Arabs do they ever run into in their lives? I mean, it was like, look, when Israel declared independence in 1948, Truman was, of course, some members of Truman's staff were saying, okay, well, we need to recognize Israel. And he had other members of his administration, the State Department, saying, wait a second, let's take this easy here. We don't want violence to break out. The Arabs were not consulted on any of this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Truman basically says, don't forget, 48, there's an election coming up in 48. There aren't that many Arabs that I have to worry about electorally, he said. That's essentially what he said. It was a political decision.
Yeah.
There's not an Arab vote that I need to worry about. That's what he said.
Yeah, well, none of these politicians care about the long term whatsoever. That's another big theme of that movie. It's just like we always joke, the exact words we use to make fun of the leaders of the right-wing parties in Israel is it's all tactics, no strategy whatsoever. Like the question we've been asking forever. It's the simplest thought experiment in the world. Oh, yeah? Who comes after Assad? The Muslim Brotherhood, if you're lucky. Right? And then what do? They go push to overthrow Assad and replace him with Al-Qaeda suicide bombers. Really? They really are that thoughtful about our foreign policy and what it has to be on their behalf. It's ridiculous. You could just take kids out of 10th grade and ask them to come up with a foreign policy and they'd do better.
I know. We can't say, well, they must know what they're doing. I mean, it's the most laughable line in the whole matter, because they what do they have to do to demonstrate that they don't know what they're doing?
I don't know. There is no answer to that question. Thanks, Sheldon.
Happy New Year, Scott.
Appreciate it. You too. That's the great Sheldon Richmond, everybody. FFF.org, the Future Freedom Foundation. Subscribe to the Future Freedom. Support the FFF. We'll be right back.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. That was funny when Sheldon was asking, when have you ever seen a Palestinian on any one of these cable TV news shows telling their side of the story? Ever? The closest thing I could come up with was the Queen of Jordan. And that was when she was on there with Pat Buchanan. And it must have been
God dang it. You know that guy with the weird name from the Morning Joe show.
Chat room guys, help me out. The guy with the weird name from the Morning Joe show. And not Brzezinski, that's a girl. Brzezinski was out sick. Here's me stalling for time. Brzezinski was out sick. Scarborough was out sick. And Barnacle, that's his name. See, it came to me. Barnacle, I think, was there but silent. Because he didn't know anything, so he stayed out of it. Maybe he had a couple things to say. But then it was Buchanan and Queen Noor. And they were talking about, yeah, man, no, really, there's such a thing as the Palestinians. Yeah, no, they're real human people, born to mothers and everything, just like all of us. They got cousins. Where they live, it seems like they're on top of a flat planet. But no, just like where you live, you know, the same planet. It's a strange coincidence. But yeah, no, they exist over there. And the Israelis rule them with a totalitarian martial law, iron fist of death and pain and humiliation. Huh, okay. Just so you know, it got onto MSNBC once. So anyway. Oh, and then, you know what? Here's third place for a Palestinian ever getting on TV after Queen Noor, who, of course, the Americans and the British have her and her royal family ruling Jordan exactly to keep the Palestinians pinned up. But anyway, after her and Pat, there was Glenn Greenwald, who's pretty Jewish for a Palestinian. But he got on to MSNBC on the, what's his name show? Spitzer. Elliot Spitzer was, this was before he had his own show. He was guest hosting for someone else, I think. And so he had all Israeli propaganda on during the attack, the Israeli attack on the Mavi Marmara. And Glenn Greenwald gets on there. He says one thing and Spitzer starts to interrupt him. And Greenwald says, no, you just had unadulterated Israeli government propaganda for half an hour. I'm going to go ahead and have my say now. And so Spitzer shuts his fat mouth. And then Greenwald destroys him. Because Greenwald, he's smart. You should understand about that guy. He's actually quite bright. Uh-huh. And so he got up there and he wasn't just right, he was bright. And so he whooped Spitzer and the rest of the Israeli agents on TV's ass with facts. And he may have implied that there are humans who actually live in Gaza. I'm sure he did address, yeah, how the Israelis keep all the aid out. That's why this is necessary. Don't lie and say you let the aid in, you're only keeping guns out, because that's a lie. The people of Gaza are children, are minors. Most of them are minors. How do you like that? The minors still, when they're the majority, Scott, I don't know. It's a paradox of human life and existence in the universe. The minority in Gazan society, they're the majority. People under 18. And they're kept on a strict diet. That's the word. I don't know the translation from Hebrew or whatever, but it's in the WikiLeaks. It was Dov Weisglass, who was an aide to the last prime minister, Ehud Olmert. Who said, yeah, you know, our plan here, what we're doing presently is, the plan is to keep them hungry. Them, the miners of the Gaza Strip, to keep them hungry, but not starving. To keep them on a diet, which I think, to plagiarize Bill Hicks, goes against the party line story, which was that the whole unlimited, endless siege of the Gaza Strip was just to keep the guns out of the hands of the bad people there. And then, of course, by the way, someone shot an IDF guard at the gates of the Gazan concentration camp there. And so the Israelis just retaliated, I guess, against Hamas positions. But they killed a 3-year-old girl. Some wiseacre tweeted that the Israelis say that the attack was in defense, in retaliation. But they didn't say what the little girl had done. What has she done? Nothing. That's one of the things that really annoys me about the endless martial law, permanent occupation of the people of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem at American expense and with American money and American weaponry to make it all go, is the collectivism inherent in it all. Oh, yeah, well, you know, tell you what we'll do. We're going to raise all of your family's olive trees that go back for millennia. And then what we're going to do is we're going to give some worthless land somewhere else to someone else. But whatever, right? It's just inherent in that whole process is all you ragheads are the same. And so to take from one and give to another, whatever. Whatever. Why get more detailed than that? Yeah, listen, it was a trade. We traded some land for some other land. It doesn't matter which Palestinians were victimized and which ones were then supposedly paid off, you know, at a rate, of course, determined only by the Israelis. And then look at this. Man, it's getting really mean over there. This is what Max Blumenthal's book is about, is that, man, it's getting really mean over there. The Netanyahu-Lieberman compromise could mean the end of Israeli-Arab MPs. This is not about the occupied West Bank, Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem. This is about, or Golan Heights for that matter, this is about the Israeli Arab citizens, the non-Jewish citizens of Israel. They don't have a nationality now, but they do have a citizenship. Got to be very careful about how we define these things there. Jewish state, first and foremost. But anyway, supposedly these people are citizens, but now what they're going to do is they're just going to end any parties that are small enough that Arabs can get elected to them, basically. The deal raised the vote threshold needed to get seats in the Knesset to 3.25% from 2%. Meaning any faction that now has 3 seats or less would get no seats at all under the new system. They were trying to raise it up to 4 so that it would count out the United Arab List. But that was going a little bit too far. So they're only going to kick some of the last of the Arabs out of the Knesset. And, of course, all along crying about how Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. Funny how we cancel everybody's elections because they elect people who hate Israel. Leaving them the only democracy in the Middle East. But, of course, they don't provide a vote to the millions of people living in East Jerusalem, the West Bank, or the Gaza Strip. They're just occupied half-slaves, basically. Third or fourth class citizens. I mean, if the Arab Israeli citizens are second class citizens, what does that make the residents of the Gaza Strip, the prisoners of it? Fifth class citizens? Is there a definitive definition of the different classes of citizens somewhere? Or is that simply a vague rhetorical type of a crap like I just used it, huh? Israel's not a democracy at all. Israel is just a white supremacist, Jim Crow, Ku Klux Klan state only run by Jews. That's all it is. It's like the Ku Klux Klan, only Jewish. And they run a state that's a lot like Mississippi in the 1950s. In the 1940s. The only democracy in the Middle East. As long as you got a ticket to the white primary. Hey, as long as your grandfather can vote, then you can vote too. Hardy har har har. Now stay off my highway and don't let me catch you drinking from my water fountain. Ain't that right, Avigdor Lieberman? What the hell? I know it sounds crazy to call Jews white supremacists, but just look at Israel. There you go. And in fact, it was one of the ministers in Benjamin Netanyahu's government who claimed just this year that what these Ethiopian and Sudanese refugees need to understand is that Israel is for the white man. Isn't that great? The white man. Just like back in the days in America. The white man. Israel is for the white man. So all you Sudanese can just get bent. We'll have the Americans buy you a ticket back to Africa. And we'll drag them kicking and screaming into a war with Iran. It's kind of funny in an outlandish sort of a crazy sort of a kind of a way, isn't it? That this system exists in the 21st century and that Uncle Sucker is on the hook for the whole thing. You know, Eric Alterman thinks that it's perfectly fine. Eric Alterman from The Nation. He doesn't mind at all the pain that this causes American citizens. In fact, he thinks that we should be more forthright about such topics. Of course, YouTube is going to screw me and not queue up. They got to show me an ad for a Jeep first, man. They're going to show me an ad for a Jeep, and then watch, they're not going to queue it up to the right spot. Well, let's see if they do. Queue up to the right spot, YouTube, for me, would you? No, of course not. Thank jerk. So well, anyway, what? It's at 39-something, isn't it? I love this clip from Eric Alterman, man. I think everyone should listen to it four times.
We need to do a lot of unpopular things in Palestine to demonstrate to the Israeli public that the only that the Palestinians have finally accepted their historic position and are going and are now ready to make the peace that the Israelis can trust. Now, I'm not saying we're anywhere near that situation.
That's not even the bad part.
Answering your hypothetical question. And that might make the United States a great deal more unpopular in the Arab world. It might increase terrorism in the Arab world. I mean, I personally think, here's a much simpler example, actually. I think that bin Laden and 9/11 were to some degree inspired by United States support for Israel. I think a great deal of the terrorist attacks and the sort of pool of terrorists, potential terrorists, who want to attack the United States are inspired by United States support for Israel. I'm not saying we shouldn't support Israel for that reason. I'm saying, damn it, if that's the price we have to pay, then I'm willing to pay it. But let's be honest about it. Let's not pretend that these things exist, that there's no, that it's unimaginable that the two states
could. It's that collectivism.
If these two states happen.
That infects this entire conversation. If 3,000 dead people other than Eric Alterman have to die in the horrific September 11th attack as the price, quote, we have to pay for supporting Israel, then screw them. He's for that. And geez, I guess he gets half credit for saying we ought to at least be honest about that. American supporters of Israel need to be honest about the consequences that people who maybe couldn't care less about Israel one way or the other have to pay. You know, like being crushed to death in a falling tower or having to decide whether to jump out the window or burn to death. Stuff like that. But you gotta admit that he's kind of brave, if only in his stupidity, out of the mouths of babes kind of a thing. Don't get me wrong, I only mean that in one sense. Obviously, Eric Alterman is a real jerk. I'm not saying he's innocent, but in a sense, he's innocent of the possibility that what he's saying is beyond the pale, right? This is a perfectly acceptable opinion to have. Well, of course, bin Laden and his minions targeted the United States, killed thousands of Americans, gave Bush and Cheney the excuse to get away with waging this massive terror war that's killed nearly a million people since, and on and on and on, all the horrors. and all the squandered wealth and everything. The piles of skulls. Hey, you know, hey, fine. I'm saying if that's the price that America, broadly defined as other people than anyone in the Alterman family, have to pay, then fine. Screw them. Screw you, America, if that's the price of supporting Israel, says Eric Alterman, Israel's number one supporter at The Nation magazine, which is, if you're not familiar, mainstream democratic liberalism. Bill Clintonian democracy. We got way too much of that.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Merry Christmas to you. It doesn't matter if that was the day before yesterday, right? It's still Christmas to me. Well, I like Christmas. Coming up here in just a few minutes, Grant F. Smith. But first, let me tell you a few things. Shop Amazon.com by way of my site, ScottHorton.org, and I'll get a little bit of a cut. Wouldn't that be nice? Here's another thing I'm going to tell you. I got this documentaries section that I started making over there at ScottHorton.org. And, well, I got every good documentary I can think of in there. Man, now that I think about it, nope, I got that one. If anybody has any suggestions, feel free to drop me an email or drop by my Facebook page and Facebook email me or tweet me, anything like that. But first, check out, there's three or four pages worth, so double check and make sure. And I'm sorry that they're all out of order. I'm going to go back through, actually, I hope, I think, perhaps. And I guess I can change the dates on them so as to group all the Vietnam stuff together, all the terror war stuff together, all the torture stuff together, and all of that kind of thing, you know? But anyway, there's some really good stuff there. If you're ever sitting around bored, you want to know what to watch, well, I found the good versions for you. You know, you're not going to have to watch everything in 10 parts. You're not going to be frustrated to find out there's no subtitles when you need them, etc. I was just mentioning to Sheldon this one, The Gatekeepers, which people have been telling me to watch forever. It's, again, interviews with former leaders of the Shin Bet internal security force there in Israel. And, man, it's great for libertarians. He talks about how one of the leaders of the Shin Bet, this is the one with a little bit of the ironical sense of humor here. He talks about how after a few years had gone by of the occupation of the West Bank, especially is what's at issue here. But after a few years of this, after the 67 war, it started kind of becoming apparent that, hey, something's got to be done here. I mean, all these Palestinians already live here, and we can't force march them out of here. Obviously, there are religious wackos who, you know, say that biblically Judea and Samaria are so important that they can never give them up ever again and whatever. Nonsense. You had military people saying it's the high ground so they can never give it up. But the leaders of the internal security force were saying, hey, you know, all these people live here. It's becoming about time to give them up. You know, to give up the territory, to make a deal. And then right around then, and I'm trying to remember now, I think it must have been the PLO guys. Maybe it was somebody else. But just then, the first intifada broke out. Or maybe this is even before the first intifada. Oh, yeah, yeah. No, no, no. This would have been way back in the late 70s. Or mid-70s. The terrorist campaign broke out. A couple of bombings and attacks on civilians. And then the entire project, and they had a project for, I guess we're going to have to, maybe it wouldn't have been successful, I don't know. But the whole idea was we're going to have to give up the West Bank. And then really bad timing on the part of the Palestinians started doing some bombings. And then that changed the entire orientation of the entire government's mission, basically. From figuring out what to do about the Palestinians to figuring out what to do about the terrorists. And the fact that the terrorism was a symptom of the occupations themselves became irrelevant. And they just, I swear, it is. It's like that TV show, Yes, Prime Minister, where, was this a thing? Yes, well, we have to do something, so let's do this. Okay, and then we'll just keep going on. The entire world is run by idiots, and especially the Israelis. They're just, God, they're so stupid. The politicians there. Why is there terrorism? Because you need to hurry up and let go of the West Bank. You held on too long already. What do? Double down. What do they think they are, Americans or something? In fact, you got to give Bush credit. Bush actually got the bases out of Saudi Arabia. Not quite good enough, because he didn't get them all out, just mostly. And he moved a lot of them just to Qatar and Bahrain and all of that. And of course, it's all the Arabian Peninsula to people who hold it as a religious affront to have Western troops occupying it, you know, as the land of Mecca and Medina and all of that. So it's a distinction without a difference if the troops are just moved to Qatar. But anyway, Bush actually gave in to bin Laden's demands. It was Paul Wolfowitz, in fact, even said, as Ron Paul likes to point out, which I like to think that Ron Paul is looking at my article where I wrote about this, where I highlighted the fact that Paul Wolfowitz told Vanity Fair that this is one of the reasons that it was such a great success that they invaded Iraq, is now they can move all their bases to Iraq and keep them there. No holy sites in Iraq, I guess, huh, guys? Anyway, but as Wolfowitz put it, our bases in Saudi Arabia were a major, a compelling part of bin Laden's recruitment propaganda against us. So we had to hurry up, get those bases out of there. It's the smart thing to do. I'm not saying we should always negotiate with terrorists, but we had no business having those bases there in the first place. So that's what Harry Brown would have done. It wouldn't have been declaring defeat. It would have been declaring, stop doing the wrong thing. Anyway, I'm off on a tangent. I'm getting back to it. If you go to my documentary section, you'll see one of the latest ones, maybe the last one I posted, is Living in Fear, Defense for Children, Palestine. And this is just, you know, what life is like for people in the occupied West Bank with the Israeli settlers constantly harassing them and attacking them and shooting at them and throwing rocks at their kids and doing everything they can to just, well, you know, like the Jim Crow South. That kind of thing. You're not welcome, you and your kind around here, boy. That kind of stuff. Trying to force the Palestinians out of their homeland. And it's pretty bad. It's pretty disgusting, really. Go to scotthorton.org/documentaries and take a look for yourself. Living in Fear, it's called. It really puts the mockery and the lie to all the propaganda about poor little Israel beset by enemies on all sides, when Israel could be making friends and has a deliberate policy not to, as everyone can see. And then the way that they trample on the ethnic and religious minorities within their, you know, so-called green line borders and their military occupation ones as well. It's completely out of control. It puts all that supposed victimhood and makes a mockery out of all of it. Anyway, we'll be back with Grant Smith in just a minute here. Oh man, I didn't get to Egypt, did I?
Hey y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey y'all, Scott here. Some stock market investors are making money hand over fist, while others sit on the sidelines afraid of the dangers. Are you looking for answers? Before you invest $1, I'd like you to take the time to watch this new video from Martin Weiss at MoneyInMarkets.com. The video names the 7 riskiest and 4 safest major stocks in America. Learn from the experts and invest wisely. Go to Crisis16.com. That's Crisis16.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is my website. Drop by the chat room. ScottHorton.org/chat. Check out the new documentaries section at ScottHorton.org/documentaries. And, of course, the stress blog and all the interview and full show archives, everything's there for you at ScottHorton.org. Follow me on Facebook or Twitter or YouTube, too, at /ScottHortonShow. If you're into that kind of thing, go like me. All right, next up is Grant F. Smith from the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. That's IRMEP.org, IRMEP.org, the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. He's also the author of a great many books about Israeli shenanigans in the United States, including Divert, New Mech, Zalman Shapiro, and the Diversion of U.S. Weapons-Grade Uranium into the Israeli Nuclear Weapons Program. Welcome back to the show, Grant. How the hell are you?
Hey, Scott. Great to be back, and thanks for mentioning the books and my hugely long titles. I've got an article with an equally long title.
Well, you know, people need to know what diversion we're talking about there, or else they might think you're trying to distract them from the real story.
Yeah, or diversion as in a carnival ride. Although sometimes, you know, it feels like I'm on a carnival ride, like, you know, we go around and around in D.C., and finally, you know, in December, the press kind of folds up its tents, and all the senators and congressmen go home. And suddenly the Israel lobby is at work, wrapping up a Christmas present to be put on greased skids in the form of a political appointee who's going to do some rather nasty things. So I thought I'd write about that, the Christmas present from AIPAC.
Yeah, well, and this one's really something else, too. I think there must have just been a lot of knowing glances and folded arms and nodding around libertarian circles and other ones, too. AIPAC's Fed candidate, Stanley Fisher.
Right.
I mean, it's just amazing that you'd have a dual citizen of any country running or helping to run the American Central Bank. But in this case, I don't know, I guess it was just ho-hum news for the major media, but pretty shocking.
Exactly.
for the rest of us.
This story is so full of question marks, and I've heard you have many informed discussions about the Fed on your show. But I do have to correct you, though, on one important point, because the nature of having a dual citizen a heartbeat away from Fed chairmanship, of course, there are Federal Reserve Acts and policies put into place about that. They have one that reads, quote, because of the special nature of the supervisory function, the need to ensure confidentiality of information, and the delegated nature of the function, unquote, they need to focus on filling slots with American citizens. But, of course, they're only talking about bank examiners. I mean, put whoever you want in the top slot.
Right. Yeah, the rules are for us little guys, even at the Fed.
Yep. I thought it was really ironic that they do have policies in place, but not for the very top slot. And, of course, the real questions that, and I've seen pieces, you know, in the Wall Street Journal and now in the Guardian, there's a big reprint of a public opinion piece saying that, hey, Stanley Fischer, put him in. You know, this is the guy for the job. But then they don't look at anything that he's done in the last 10 years. They don't explore at all the dual citizenship aspect and why this would be a major change in terms of having openly dual U.S.-Israeli citizens in top quasi-governmental posts, and barely even quote any of his critics, one of them who was a former chief economist at the IMF, Simon Johnson, who says he doesn't know what he stands for on regulation. So here's this guy, that a person who knows him quite well, one of his former students and worked at the IMF, as did Fischer, saying, what is this guy, he says, quote, what is the rationale for his candidacy? So I tried to answer that question in terms of looking at what he's been doing all these years.
Yeah, and so the implication being it's all about who he knows and what he's willing to do for them rather than any real expertise that he brings to the fore,
as though any experts know
how to run the American Central Bank correctly.
Right, right. I mean, the guy obviously has experience. He's run, MIT's economics department. He's obviously smart. He wrote a textbook that everyone has to use basically to learn about macroeconomics, but none of that really matters. I mean, the real question is, what is it that he wants to do, and do any of his policy prescriptions that he applies, are they universal, or is he actually an operative who has a special cause that he's been caring for all of these years? And I would argue that he does. And that special cause at this particular time could be quite dangerous for America.
All right. Now, you mentioned how he was a commissar at the IMF. For how long, and what did he do then? Was there anything about Israel that we need to know that he did then?
Well, when he was at the IMF, he made a name for himself when he became first deputy managing director in 1994 in terms of going into economies like Mexico, developing economies, Thailand, Indonesia, Brazil, Russia, and Argentina, and imposing austerity programs. You know, when these countries were high growth, but suddenly they hit a wall of confidence that caused all of their investors to pull out, he was the kind of economic hitman who would go in there and say, okay, you've got to cut all your social spending programs, you've got to close down these industries, you've got to make yourself put yourself into this sort of mode of government spending. And he acquired a lot of critics for kind of the unnecessary harshness in some cases in some of that, and really paved the way for players like Venezuela to come in and say, you know what, we're not going to be as vicious in proposing bailouts in the future. You can just borrow money for us. So in some sense, he was kind of one of the reasons why a lot of these economies turned away from the IMF and really tanked its reputation. But then he went to Citigroup, recruited directly by Sanford Sandy Whale.
All right, now wait a minute. Because I want to hear about the Citigroup thing. And of course, he went from the IMF to Citigroup. That was his reward.
Well, of course.
But it's worth dwelling on the point about the IMF for a little while there, and especially during that era where, you know, I don't know, maybe one could argue that there's some good faith and bad economics that just really says strangling the hell out of everything is just, it all makes good sense, like cutting government spending or whatever. But really what they're doing in a lot of cases is straight gangsterism, where they're taking what are basically public resources, or at least up until that time, publicly owned, government-owned and controlled resources like water and electricity, and just seizing them and turning them over to politically connected companies who oftentimes, you know, like they're liquidating the former Soviet Union or something. They just destroy whatever it is, take the money and run, you know, liquidate all the assets and go. Don't even operate it anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. It triggers a lot of resentment and in some cases semi-revolutionary reactions. When they take, for example, a rural phone collective that people put money into to buy the copper and string the lines, and then suddenly they come in, they make some legal changes of dubious nature, privatize it, hand it over to a group of foreign investors who are now going to assume 100% or majority ownership. That's the kind of thing that not only, you know, makes people mad at the corruption involved, but it can trigger basically a revolutionary backlash. And the last one of those I ever saw directly was in Bolivia when that happened. So, yeah, it's very... you know, that's why that book, Economic Hitman, is so good, because it kind of describes a lot of the things that happen under the guise of very innocuous names in terms of just ripping ownership away and transferring it to others, insiders in particular. So, yeah.
Right. Well, and you know, you mentioned about, you know, Venezuela stepping into the breach there when everybody got so sick of the IMF. Greg Palast always pointed out that Hugo Chavez always got along with Houston. You know, he could beat his chest all he wanted and whatever, but when it came to time to meet with the guys from Shell and do business, he always did business just fine with them. They never really had a problem. It was the government that was angry at him because he had taken $20 billion out of the Federal Reserve, and then, like you said, like you were talking about there, he turned around and used that to undercut the IMF and give loans to all the developing economies of Latin America, only without all the gangsterism. No, really, just pay me back a few percent when you get around to it. It's all right. And so completely undercut the IMF because nobody wanted to do business with them at all. They didn't have any reason to at all anymore once he started doing that.
They never closed down Citgo, and Houston never retooled its heavy crude refineries because they knew they had a constant, very welcome neighboring supplier. It had nothing to do with oil, and the oil continues to flow.
And of course, if it had been the oil, Palast would have been the first one to let us know exactly why it was the oil, you know? You know, that's kind of his specialty is big business hoisting and controlling of these, you know, what he would consider obviously public resources.
Right. It had a lot to do with taking the hands of the very wealthy Cisneros family off the oil spigot in Venezuela and exiling them to New York, where they could continue to launch intrigue. So,
I don't know enough about that.
These are the things that you won't see on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, but if you ever go to Venezuela and talk to people, which I have, that's front and center on a lot of their minds. They understand who the families are and what the actual politics affecting all of these things are, including, you know, the coups and all the intrigues.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see why the oil refiners don't really care about stuff like that, but that doesn't mean nobody does.
They should, you know, and here we have Fisher, who's been really kind of the grandfather to Ben Bernanke and to a lot of these key economics figures who circulated in, privatized Russia, all of that. And the actual records are rarely examined in depth in terms of, you know, look at the numbers, look at the positions they held in groups and what came out of those groups. And so one of the reasons I think that Fisher is an interesting figure to plug in straight from the Israeli Federal Bank or Central Bank is some of his activities back in the 80s, where this is before he was becoming sort of the king of austerity programs. The first bailout that he engineered was as part of the U.S.-Israel Joint Economic Discussion Group in the Reagan administration, where he basically took the opposite approach, because instead of, you know, some country that he didn't have any affinity with, of course, the country in question, the country that came begging to the United States in 1984, for billions and billions of dollars in aid that basically, you know, added up to about $1,600 for every Israeli was the state of Israel. And he comes in and basically, I think, shows his true colors in not only switching all U.S. aid to Israel from loans that had to be repaid, but also engineering the unilateral lowering of U.S. tariffs on just about every product Israel manufactures so that they can add, or they could have duty-free access to the United States, which was a tremendous boost to their economy. And if you go through all of the material about what was going on and who was lobbying, AIPAC was always pushing Fisher as the person who was the economic guru who would help the Israelis out and who would also help the United States. But, of course, it was always one-sided. It was always the United States with the costs and Israel with the benefits.
Mm-hmm. Well, and now what about Iran? Because you talk about that specifically.
Well, Iran has been, you know, basically, Iran has been his work over the almost past decade. He was the landing spot in Israel for people like Stuart Levy of the Treasury Department's Office of Finance and Terrorism, new spot that was created by heavy AIPAC lobbying. He would be the one who would go over to Israel, meet with Fisher, meet with Mossad, meet with all of the top officials in Israel to try and use sanctions as a bat to beat up on China, Russia, and Europe. He and Levy would be both running around to all of these countries, ostensibly speaking on behalf of the West, as they said, to get the last holdouts from trading with Iran, from doing anything that they construed as being in violation of these really Israel-centric sanctions that, of course, they claim it's to stop Iran from developing nuclear weapons, but, you know, there's no evidence that they've had a program in recent times. So they would be running around doing pressure campaigns on European...
That's
Chinese
amazing. Wait, so in other words, what they're doing is... They're going through the letter of the law as issued by the Security Council and or the American Treasury Department, and then they're just taking it upon themselves to cold call every financial institution in the Western Hemisphere and threaten them and say, you better not be doing one penny of business with the Iranians because we're watching you and we'll turn you into the U.S. Treasury in a minute.
Absolutely, absolutely, and of course...
That's been his job this whole time as the head of the Israeli Central Bank.
That's basically when you look at not the U.S. reporting on it, but when you look at his statements on television in Israel, when you look at his work, basically where he's strategizing that they needed to take sanctions beyond what had already been passed in the Security Council and use this pressure campaign, you can see that they're using these sanctions and basically AIPAC's power in Congress as a bat that they can beat over the head of, you know, a country like India or China that wants to buy Iranian oil and trade with them. And so it is...
Well, and every kind of shipping company, I mean, this is the thing, too, that people really need to understand is any shipping company is terrified of doing any business with Iran, no matter what the cargo, they rather just not. And that's why we're having such a big problem, you know, with medicine imports and all these kinds of most important things that the people of Iran need is because it's almost completely choked off their international trade, with the exception of the oil that they're still selling to our allies in the East. But
yeah, it's ironic that this person and later the Federal Reserve, which is so active in condemning the Arab League boycott of Israel, which would basically use their economic power to say, look, we don't want to do business with countries that are, you know, working with Israel because they've launched all of these wars in the region. They're basically seeing the power that a boycott can have and trying to, you know, leverage it to the nth degree, except that there is really no basis for this boycott other than the fact that it takes a lot of attention off Israel's own actions and unfinished business in terms of the Palestinians, and puts it on a focus on a, you know, a regional rival of theirs that supports a lot of groups that they don't like. So
right.
It's you know, it's ironic that you know, after the Federal Reserve has been this primary anti-boycott instrument that now, under Fisher, it could well become one of the even more robust in terms of the secondary boycott that you're talking about.
Right. Well, now, I was actually surprised to read in your article here, Grant, and again, everybody, it's Grant Smith from IRMEP, I-R-M-E-P, IRMEP.org, Stanley Fisher, APAC's Fed candidate on the Iran warpath, and you have here, oh, hell, I'm paging down trying to find it. I was surprised to see some, what, Chamber of Commerce types or something had done a study complaining, you know, concluding that these sanctions are costing the American economy a lot, too, and complaining about that. Business Roundtable, Coalition for American Trade, right?
Right. If, you know, if there were better reporting on this at all, we would already know this. But, of course, you know, Israel lobbying organizations and their friend of the media don't mention it. But the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Business Roundtable, Coalition for American Trade, National Foreign Trade Council, and I didn't see this until fairly recently, but they wrote a letter to Nancy Pelosi basically saying, if you implement sanctions in the way that you're doing right now, you will cost the American economy $25 billion and 210,000 American jobs. And that really rang a bell to me, because one of the big things that Fisher engineered back in the 80s was, again, this so-called free trade agreement, which is actually an aid package to Israel, which had a huge effect as well on jobs and exports. And so they're basically making the case that if they implemented these harsh sanctions and secondary boycotts, American businesses and jobs are going to be hurt. Well, you know, a Fisher or an APAC or a lot of these so-called analysts in the media, they're not going to mention the cost. All they do is mention the benefits, which are, you know, to them, strangulating the Iranian economy. And the thing to know about Fisher, the most important thing to know, which none of the news media outlets have looked at, is that he came to the conclusion relatively late in his boycott enforcement campaign that the Iranian economy was not going to collapse. And he began staging exercises in Israel to prepare the economy for an inevitable war on Iran. And so his last statements, again, picked up in the Israeli press, but not in the U.S. press, were that he was trying to make the economy as robust as possible to be able to transcend a war with Iran. And so suddenly he's here, and suddenly he's going to enter a position in the U.S. banking system where he could do exactly the same thing, raising the question of whether this highly connected to the Israeli government person already knows that the Israelis plan on launching an attack and dragging the U.S. into it, along with APAC's help.
Don't worry, Grant. The Fed chairmanship and vice chairmanship, it's a professional position. These guys leave all their personal feelings and connections and conflicts of interest out of it, and they do the right thing for the American economy, which is never, ever, 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 ever stop printing money. Everybody knows that.
Okay.
And that's why they're independent from Congress, because if Congress controlled the money supply, they would print money all day long. And so we need the Federal Reserve there so that they can print the money.
What is it, $4 trillion in assets they have on their balance sheet? It's I heard a discussion on your show a while back about that.
And they're still fighting over whether they're going to have a real audit or not, so I don't think we really know, do we?
And, you know, that's the real, you know, the only thing that could stop this nomination, this sudden nomination launched while everyone's asleep from going through, is the audit the Fed that Rand Paul wants, and that the House Minority Leader said, we've got to debate that. But, you know, they fixed it and announced it to everybody that there will be no debate on Stanley Fisher's nomination. So what you say must be true. He must be an angel, because if there's no need to debate and the Wall Street Journal says so, then, you know, why even bother?
Well, you know, I wonder about why even have a chairman or a vice chairman or whatever. You could just let, you know, a Windows 2000 machine run the monetary policy, just print money. You know, what's so sophisticated about that? What kind of arguments do they have at the Open Market Committee? Should we print money or should we print money? Let's print money. All right, come on, guys, we'll print money.
Yeah,
we'll buy bad debt with it. Okay.
I don't think that's Fisher's I don't think that's Fisher's concern. I think he came rushing back to the United States with some good reasons for coming back, and I just think that if there were a bona fide debate about everything that he brings to the table, there's absolutely no way that the Senate would confirm him if they were responding to any sort of informed input from the constituents. But I don't think even the Business Roundtable has issued any sort of statement on this. The most critical thing I've seen come out was reported by a former AIPAC lobbyist who was caught up in an espionage scandal. And so I tend to treat in the article his input as being suspect and mainly to assuage people in the on the left and in the Nation magazine like Eric Alterman that the guy wants peace. So I did hear your little piece about that, how horrible a lot of the reporting is all over the place. But this person, absent any scrutiny and input, is going to be the next undersecretary over there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's their idea of cushioning the economy during a war, too, if you accept their premise that they've got to have a war here. And that's how they managed to get away with the Iraq thing for the first little while there, is they just sent everybody a $300 check in the mail, leading people to believe that, I guess war is good for the economy. This is my dividend from that Iraq adventure I let the Republicans have or whatever. They'll
sure.
do the same thing again. I mean, that's the only thing they could do is just keep printing money.
Well, Fisher gave a long interview to PBS in which he seemed to ascribe a lot of the ills of the economy to periods between major wars, and it made me wonder whether he actually sees the demand and supply and concentration of decision making that happens during war as a positive thing. But
you said he wrote the macro textbook, right? He must be wrong about everything. And that sounds exactly like the kind of premise that I would expect somebody like him to bring to the table. That's the same thing that George W. Bush said, right? Remember the I forgot if it was the leader of Bolivia or Argentina or something, quoted him to Oliver Stone saying that George Bush said, well, you know, everybody knows if you want a good economy, you got to have a war.
That's what they all think. State of affairs.
Keynesians left and right. You know, the Chicago School, they're all just a bunch of Keynesians, too. They all believe the same stuff. It was Dick Cheney said deficits don't matter, remember?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess, trade deficits don't either. But actually, in reality, they do matter. So it's, we're going to see. I think we're going to find out the hard way that this person who's made so many pronouncements but has a real attachment to the key driver in terms of the key lobbyist for attacking Iran. I think he's come back to America for a reason.
Yeah. Well, and as you point out here, too, very important point here right at the end, about if you could have the vice chairman of the Fed be a dual citizen of Israel, well, why not the head of the FBI? Why not the head of Homeland Security or any other agency, right? Why not let Tel Aviv appoint all of our officials for us?
Indeed. I mean, how much difference would it make from the people who have been vetted and put in there already? That's a good question.
Welcome to the bottom of the slippery slope, everybody. All right. Thanks, Grant. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
That's Grant F. Smith, IRMEP.org. IRMEP.org.